More than 500,000 people work in meatpacking plants across America, and for many workers, the pace can be absolutely brutal. Here's one worker sharing his story with Harvest Public Media.
You see the pigs going faster, faster. You stop the chain because there is a problem. They come, I'm yelling, hey, let's go, let's go.
Plus, a new law says public schools must provide a space to breastfeed. We learn why it could ease the pressure off mothers who are going to school. And the holidays can be the most wonderful time of year, and they can also be the most stressful.
Cooking, wrapping, decorating, and shopping.
I don't think I can do this sober.
You guys want to get drunk at the food court?
Ooh, yeah.
Even if you're not Mila Kunis in the movie Bad Moms Christmas, you still probably have a lot to do this holiday season. We'll hear from two psychologists on how to manage all that stress. That's coming up this hour on the 21st. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo. The average American eats nearly 200 pounds of meat each year, and there are more than 500,000 people working at meatpacking plants all over the country. This work can be incredibly dangerous. According to a 2016 study by the Government Accountability Office, meatpacking workers suffer the highest rate of injury compared to any other industry in the country. Last Thursday, that same agency called on the federal government to do more to protect meatpacking workers. The report says not only are many of these workers exposed to dangerous chemicals, but they aren't allowed bathroom breaks, and they're even turned away from medical treatment. Joining me now from Kansas City is Peggy Lowe, investigations editor at Harvest Public Media. Also on the line from Boston is Alex Gallimbardi, senior advocacy and collaborations advisor with Oxfam America. Peggy, Alex, welcome to the 21st.
Good morning, Liz.
Good morning.
Good morning, Liz. Thank you.
Thank you for joining, Alex. Peggy, I want to start with you. So you and the folks at Harvest Public Media have been reporting on this issue. And as we just mentioned, there are about 500,000 people in America working at meatpacking plants. So can you give us a sense of where these plants are located and just how big they are?
Absolutely. These are really huge factories, essentially, that produce all the meat we eat. You know, when you see those big white plastic containers with the red meat in your grocery store, this is where they come from. And these workers are mostly located in rural areas. For instance, there's a huge feedlot area in southwest Kansas. It's very remote, you know, very little population, small towns out there. And there's huge meatpacking plants out there, at least a couple that I know of. And that goes the same for the rest of the country, in part because it's kind of stinky when you raise a lot of animals. And even the production of this meat is kind of smelly, and it produces some pollution runoff and that kind of thing. And so most of the meat companies have moved their production into rural areas of the country.
And Alex, can you give us a sense of who's working at these meatpacking plants? What are the demographics of the workers themselves?
Yes, and specifically talking about poultry, the poultry processing plants, compared to meatpacking or red meat processing, you can see that there's a higher concentration of minority workers, of women working on the lines. Depending on the company, you see just over 50% of these workers in the processing plants will be women. And
okay.
There's a growing number of immigrant and refugee workers that work in these plants. Throughout the country, depending on the state, there will be a higher population of African refugee workers, or in other states, there are a growing population of Latino and Latin American, Central American immigrants, and immigrants also from other parts of the world, from Southeast Asia as well.
So I'd like to give our listeners a sense of what it's like inside these meatpacking companies and factories. So what are some of the main tasks that a typical worker would be expected to carry out, and what parts of their job pose the biggest safety risk? Oh, and Alex,
so
if you could, sorry.
Yeah, so the tasks on these processing lines are very specialized tasks. These disassembly lines, as we refer to them, they work where each worker has one task that they do over and over thousands of times. a day, and they will be divided into different parts of the line. So the part where there's a lot of manual labor happening in a chicken processing plant is at the beginning of the line, when there's the what's called the receiving line, where the chickens arrive, and they are taken out of the crates. They are transported in, and it's the live hanging area where the live birds are hanged into shackles that then go to the stunning and slaughtering line. And then after the defeathering, they come to the evisceration line where the guts are pulled out, and then they start going into further processing where the carcass is breaking down into different portions, and a worker will get just one task that they have to do over and over. So one worker might be assigned the task to pull the breast meat off of the ribs and the chest. Another worker will have the task of cutting off wings or doing specific cuts that they would do repeatedly, multiple times per minute.
And Peggy, can you give us a better idea of which parts of the line, so to speak, pose the biggest safety risk for workers?
Well, I would suggest that virtually any spot on the line would be a safety risk. I'm so glad Alex is talking about chicken processing, because that sort of industry is mostly centered on the southern and east coast, and even like down into Arkansas, mostly. Not all. But then, for instance, out here in the Midwest, because I'm based in Kansas City, you've got a lot of beef and a lot of pork processing. Mm-hmm. So as Alex was saying, you know, people are standing at their stations, and they stand there for more than 8 hours a day, and they do what are called these micro tasks, you know, picking like, here's the breast out of that, here's the wing out of that. And they have their hands up in the air, and they're cutting along because these animal carcasses are moving along what they call the chain. You know, this is the production line, and people are cutting and making thousands and thousands and thousands of little tiny cuts and or large cuts. Say if it's like, say, a side of beef, they're, you know, really putting their knife in deep and cutting deeply, and that takes a lot of muscle too. So there's that part which comes right off the slaughter. And then there's another whole section where the beef and the pork and the chicken is boxed up, and so that's really cold, and so people have to wear a lot of heavy clothes underneath their white coats, and then they're boxing this up, and it's real heavy lifting, and they're, you know, moving it on to trucks and that sort of thing to get out of the plant. So there's a variety of these kinds of jobs, and quite frankly, they're all very dangerous. In fact, meatpacking is, according to the government, one of the most dangerous jobs in the U.S.
Yeah, and it sounds like a lot of repetitive movement, too. So if you get injured, there's no way to really avoid your injury, right? Like, it's like, oh, I'll do something else for a while. You have to continue to do the same movement. And really getting into this idea of the types of injuries that meatpacking workers have to experience and go through. First, we have a clip from one of the workers that you spoke to for your story. Her name is Teresa, and she was 31 at the time that this happened.
And I said, okay, why are you guys sending me back to the line when I have pain? And I need to go see another doctor. I need to go take more therapy. And they told me, I'm sorry. The doctor said, you're going to learn how to live with pain for the rest of your life.
As I mentioned, that was taped from your reporting as a part of Harvest Public Media. So the woman's name was Teresa. She worked at a pork processing plant in Nebraska for 5 years until the injury to her shoulder forced her to quit. So, Peggy, can you tell us more about her experiences and how they are similar to other injuries that you see among meatpacking workers?
Of course. So her injuries are very much like what a lot of folks go through. I've had even men tell me, you know, I went into the pork plant, to the beef plant, whatever, as a young man, and I came out 5 years later as an old man.
Wow.
It's really, really hard work on a person's body. So with Teresa, I mean, she was young. She was in her 20s. And she really liked the job because it pays pretty well. You know, it's going to pay a lot more than, say, a Walmart or something like that out in these rural areas. They can make 10, 11, 12 bucks an hour. So that's a pretty good wage. And sometimes they also get some health benefits. So but she started, she was like, you know, employee of the year her first couple years there. And she was tasked with cutting hams and rolling them, you know, in the plastic and sending them on down the line. And after like 2-3 years, she started getting these repetitive motion, you know, these muscular skeletal disorders. They're called MSDs. They're sprains, strains, pains, inflammation, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So if she could get off the line, she would be told to go to the doctor. Well, the company pays for the doctor, and the doctor says, you're fine, take some Tylenol, put some ice on it, get back on the line. I think she ultimately did have a surgery, but it didn't really help. And ultimately, after 5 years, she said, I'm out of here. She was, I think, on her second child. And she told me that it was particularly painful because, so she quit to be a stay-at-home mom because her husband actually worked in a different packing plant. And she said she was home taking care of her babies, and it just so upset her that just even, like, say, tear up their food or feed them little bites of food and then hold them in her arms, it was really painful.
So, Alex, I want to talk to you about state safety standards. So what are the rules that are in place to protect meatpacking workers, if at all?
So the regulations are not the best, but there are regulations that protect workers. There are OSHA rules that protect workers from receiving these types of injuries, that when workers start to develop the MSDs that Peggy referred to, that workers should receive medical attention, that they should be given medical leave. But sadly enough, the problem that we see in the poultry plants and we hear from workers in states across the country that have concentrations of poultry plants is that it is a widespread problem in the industry that companies engage in a system of denying culpability for these injuries, denying treatment to the workers that are experiencing these musculoskeletal disorders, so that the companies will not be liable for their healthcare costs.
Mm-hmm.
And also because if a worker has to take time off work due to any of these injuries, this becomes a reportable injury that has to be reported on the OSHA log. And that can trigger inspections in the plant, that can trigger a whole set of issues that these companies want to avoid.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a big issue and a challenge that Oxfam has and many of the organizations that we work with the data that is touted by the National Chicken Council, saying that injury rates are going down in this industry. Even OSHA has commented on that this data of injuries going down might not be accurate because of widespread underreporting of injuries that workers are experiencing.
Right. And so, Peggy, underreporting, sticking on that topic for a minute, we already know that meatpacking workers, as we've talked about, and as we've said multiple times here, have the highest rate of injury really than any other worker in America. And as Alex was just talking about, they're underreported. So what gets in the way of a worker reporting an injury? What things are they worried about from their personal perspective?
I'm glad you brought up this idea of underreporting because, as Alex said, the industries, the meat industries, like to say that, you know, injuries are going down and the workers are better protected. Well, we don't know if that is, in fact, that accurate because workers fear reporting injuries or they fear reporting any sort of problems to their supervisors and or OSHA because, as Alex said, you know, that triggers certain things that brings attention to the plant. The worker feels retaliation or fears retaliation from the company. I mean, they fear like, you know, they could lose their job or say they could be deported or perhaps they don't speak English as a first language and they're confused about that and you just put your head down and keep working. The idea that all these numbers are underreported too, not just OSHA admits that, this GAO report that you mentioned when you opened your show, Liz, that also talks about it too. And OSHA numbers have always been chronically underreported. So that's been a decades-long problem.
So what have the meatpacking companies done about these safety concerns? Has there been a larger conversation, or are we just now having that?
I think that we are starting to have it more and more. Now, meat companies have always had to, you know, focus on some sort of worker safety because there are, as Alex said, some government regulations about that. Now, these government regulations aren't always really strictly enforced, but there's more consumer awareness about food in general. So, for instance, people are worried about animal welfare when it comes to meat.
Mm-hmm.
So there's more attention to that. And now I'm really hoping that consumers, too, will pay attention to the idea that workers are also being very, you know, treated not too well in these meatpacking plants. So more and more the companies are paying attention. For instance, Tyson, one of the largest, has instituted some new workplace safety initiatives, which are pretty interesting, which include more regulated bathroom breaks, which is a major problem that Oxfam has brought to light, and this GAO report, too, that people don't get bathroom breaks, and so they often have to wear, like, diapers.
Wow.
Or even soil themselves while working the line because they're not allowed to take bathroom breaks. So the meat companies know this is some pretty bad publicity, so they are trying to do some things that will hopefully help these workers.
So, Alex, before we run out of time, I want to get back to something that you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation, that many of these workers are women, which I think would surprise a fair amount of people, but they're also Latino and they're immigrants. So has the national political climate affected this issue in the sense of what we're talking about, the conditions of meatpacking factories, and our conversation and concerns about those conditions?
Absolutely. I think that for the past several years, there has already been a climate of fear in these poultry plants where workers feel threatened and feel like they do not have the ability to speak up about problems. And in the past 12 months, we have seen this climate
okay.
of fear rise exponentially, where we hear from partners in the ground, the worker centers, the
right.
organizations
well,
that work directly.
Alex,
with
I'm going to let you finish that thought. I apologize. We do have to take a quick break, but I want to get right back to you here in just a second. Stay tuned to the 21st. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo. We've been talking to Peggy Lowe, investigations editor at Harvest Public Media, as well as Alex Gallimbardi, a senior advocacy and collaborations advisor with Oxfam America, about the safety concerns for the over 500,000 meatpacking workers here in America. And Alex, we were talking about the role of immigration in all of this and a greater national political climate and how that affects this conversation around safety concerns. So if you could pick up your thought there.
Yes. So the growing climate of fear where immigrants and refugees and minority workers in this industry feel threatened and feel like they cannot speak up when there are safety concerns or other type of concerns that they experience in the plants for fear of retaliation, mm-hmm. fear of losing their jobs, fear of ostracizing the communities. And this is contributing to an issue that the North American Meat Institute commented on in their response to the GAO report, which is that this industry is experiencing a tight market, which is, as far as my agreement with their comment goes, that this tight job market, it has a lot to do with this current immigration climate, where we've even heard from companies that sometimes their plants are not staff to capacity because workers are just not showing up if there's a threat of a ICE raid or something like that.
And Peggy, before we go and wrap this conversation up, as someone who's reported on this issue for Harvest Public Media, what are some of the big questions on meatpacking safety that you're thinking about as we look ahead that you want to take a deeper dive into?
Well, as we reported just last summer, we did an investigative series called Dangerous Jobs, Cheap Meat, which is found on our website. And one of the big things that really popped out to us is that, you know, there are deaths, there are injuries, there are these chronic problems that are coming out of the meatpacking plants. And OSHA's fines are so low. For instance, they're typically negotiated down to roughly about $11,000 when someone dies or when someone's permanently injured. And so I think that there needs to be more scrutiny from Congress on this. Given the climate, however, in Washington right now, I don't see that happening. But I know that a lot of folks have called on Congress to do something about that.
That was Peggy Lowe, investigations editor at Harvest Public Media. We also heard from Alex Gallimberti, senior advocacy and collaborations advisor with Oxfam America. Peggy, Alex, I want to thank you for joining our conversation today on the 21st.
Thank you.
Thank you, Liz. It was my pleasure.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo. In 2015, more than 8,000 teen mothers gave birth, according to the Illinois Department of Public Health. And new teen moms heading back to school face a lot of obstacles when they return to the classroom. A new state law might make that transition easier. It goes into effect January 1st and requires public schools in Illinois to provide a room for students to breastfeed, meaning a room besides the bathroom, which is where many students have had to pump and feed in the past. The law also says that the room must have an electrical outlet and a fridge where students can store milk. Finally, students cannot be penalized for missing class due to needing to pump. Although the American Academy of Pediatrics recommends breastfeeding for at least the first 6 months, a study from the CDC and the Illinois Department of Public Health finds more teenage mothers switch to formula within the first few weeks than their older counterparts. Joining me on the line from Chicago is Pat Mosina. She's the founder and president of Options for Youth. Also joining us here in our Urbana studios today is Don Owen, superintendent for the Urbana School District. Also, Pat, Don, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Liz.
So, Pat, your organization supports vulnerable youth in Chicago. So I'm curious why it was important for you to focus on an issue, on this particular issue, making it easier to breastfeed in public schools.
Well, Options for Youth has worked with very young teen mothers, all of whom have a baby before the age of 18. So they're adolescent mothers for over two decades. And our home visitors step in next to this young mother and her baby and do whatever it takes to keep her from falling through the cracks and to graduate from high school. We've served over 5,000 young mothers across the state as part of the Illinois Subsequent Pregnancy Program. And currently, or for the last 10 years, we have partnered with CPS and currently the Department of Family and Social and Support Services here in Chicago to serve 100 high school students each year. And our young fathers and young mothers in our programs face a broad range of obstacles.
Yes, and I would like to...
Breastfeeding being only one of them.
Yeah, and breastfeeding in public spaces can be hard enough, I think, for any mother of any age. But I'm curious, when you're working with these young moms, what are some of the challenges that they're facing, especially as teen moms, and especially when they have to head back into the classroom?
Well, many of our teen moms are actually homeless. And and with no food or heat in their apartments, you know, some of them are facing survival with a young baby. But with the support of our home visitors and their home schools, I'd like to give you some specific examples. They have been able to breastfeed specifically, but this requires additional support, support from the principals, from the school, and from their home visitor. In 2015, we have been in Bogan High School, working with the young mothers and fathers in Bogan High School for almost 10 years. But in 2015, our home visitor and the school principal, Mrs. Sims, recognized the need to provide additional support. And that came about by young mother, one particular young mother who came back who was determined to breastfeed, mm-hmm. but she had no place to pump and she was leaking. And this was quite obvious. So the principal, we had worked with her, and she gave us options for youth, a room, had curtains put up, and the options board bought a refrigerator. So the young mothers at Bogan since 2015 have had a place to pump, a refrigerator to store. We had two, I'd like to give you two more stories at Bogan that show what these young mothers have overcome.
Well, actually, I'd like to get to that in just a moment, Pat. Sorry okay. about that. We'll get to those stories here in just a minute. I want to continue this idea of support from school administration. So yes. we have Superintendent Don Owen here in the studio with us, and I want to bring you into the conversation because your school here in Urbana already has a room like this, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
So what does it look like? Can you give us an idea of what it is on the day-to-day? Is it used exclusively for this purpose, or is it only between particular hours, that sort of thing?
No, right now we have an actual room that's dedicated for this purpose, and it's not just for students, but it's also for staff.
Okay.
And in the past, we have done a variety of kind of makeshift things. We've always tried to prevent a student from feeling like they need to pump or mm-hmm. You know, worst case scenario, nurse in a restroom. So we've provided spaces in, offices, social work offices, nursing offices to do that. But now we have a dedicated space. And I would say right now it's not used on a daily basis just because of our school is fairly small. There are, 1,100 students.
Right.
We don't always have nursing mothers or nursing mm-hmm. staff.
So I am curious, what did the school district have to do in order to make this happen? Was there a lot of talk about it? What was the process? Did you get a lot of pushback or feedback from parents?
Right. So I would say that we got very little pushback except for positive kind of affirmation saying thank you for providing this. But in terms of discussion, it's more along the lines of what we do to make sure that students are in school and attending. Any obstacle that we can take away from any student mm-hmm. Regarding attendance, we're going to do just as a matter of course. And so there really wasn't a huge amount of discussion for this. It was just a matter of saying, okay, where's the most logical space? How can we make sure that that space is dedicated, comfortable, and available for students?
So, Pat, bringing you back into the conversation, before this bill was signed into law, what was the situation like for an average teen mother who was needing to breastfeed during school hours? Are you finding it's more like Urbana where they took steps without the law and they took the initiative, or that they really struggled?
It really depended upon the school administration. We had some schools like Bogan who were totally supportive. I would say the majority, the young mothers did have to struggle more. With Bogan, that is the only school who has, to my knowledge, they will, but up till this point has dedicated a room. It's the options for youth room, but it was dedicated for breastfeeding students and staff. Since 2015, we've served about 40 young mothers, and I mm-hmm. think 15 of those were breastfeeding. Now, this requires that the home visitor begin when she is still on homebound and helps her add this to all the many things she has to do as a high school student with a baby.
Right. Well, and are you concerned when you're talking about school administration, or if you're advocating on behalf of these moms to a school that's maybe not so keen on the idea, that they're going to have to make difficult choices as far as providing a space for a student mother to breastfeed versus classroom space? Are you finding any pushback there?
In most of the schools, space is limited. But in the schools that we've been working in for a long time, they have given us an options for youth office, and that we have used for this kind of thing in the past. We did have a dedicated options for youth office where a home visitor was there 3 or 4 days a week, and we would use that space. So we would not have to push it through school administration, they were supportive of us because we had an office there, and we would use that space.
Well, that's good. And Don, are you finding, well, to kind of take a step back here, there is some general understanding that there's still stigma around breastfeeding, especially when it happens in public. So when you're talking about implementing this in your school, and you're saying that you didn't really get any negative feedback from parents, but did you find that students that maybe aren't always so kind to one another, was there any stigma among students?
Not really. I mean, I don't have any firsthand knowledge of that. I mean, I think Pat's exactly right that one of the biggest things we can do is support our students and educate all students. And that's not just about breastfeeding and nursing and teen parenthood, but it's also about how to respond in a way that is accepting and supporting of your fellow students. And that's kind of a deeper kind of cultural thing that we work on as a school. And I think that that helps students who have traditionally felt marginalized feel more welcome and supported at school.
So what I'm hearing from you is that your number one goal is student retention. You want to make sure that it's a good environment, that students don't feel that leaving is their best option, right?
Yeah, yes. And that goes back to kind of our mission of equity, excellence, and engagement. I think one of the things I'll say about listening to Pat speak is the importance of community partners. And, you know, we work with our social workers and high school administration, work with the teachers and our school-based health center staff, the practitioners there, as well as a number of community agencies to support teen mothers and make sure that they are successful and engaged in their education.
Well, and Pat, as you mentioned earlier, which I was surprised by, I must admit, many of your teen mothers that you work with are facing homelessness. So I imagine that just piles on the obstacles, correct?
If you're 15 and you have to get out of a homeless shelter with a baby on your hip, get the baby to child care, and you're supposed to be at algebra by 8 o'clock, it's a big challenge.
So,
And Don is so right. Student retention is key, especially for these teen parents. And we do everything we can to maintain that retention. Our high school graduation rates for our young mothers in our program are twice the national average.
Wow.
But, again, our young mothers have a home visitor who is doing what it takes. We spend a lot of time advocating with the schools because our young mothers miss a lot. And I know Don understands that, but if the baby's sick or she has no child care, she has to miss. And some schools have used that as a reason for discharging our young mothers. We do go against that a lot. But I wanted to tell you about two of our young moms at Brogan who did breastfeed. These were both 2015. One of the young mothers was valedictorian.
Okay.
But her baby was born with an infection. So she would pump at school and then take her milk to the baby in the hospital because he had to stay in the hospital for a couple of months. So she was determined to do this and knew how important it was for the health of her baby. And the other young mother had a very, very premature baby.
Okay.
And again, she would pump at school, put it in the refrigerator, and then after school she would go to the hospital and take the baby the milk. Again, these were two very determined young mothers. They had the support of her home visitor and the school, but they were able to do it. Now, another key issue, and Don, I don't know whether you have to deal with this or not in terms of breastfeeding, but the grandmother, the baby's grandmother, is a key factor in whether that young mother can breastfeed or not.
Absolutely.
If she's for it, it happens. If she's not for it, it does not happen.
Well, and Don, we only just have a couple seconds here, so if you could summarize pretty quickly. I was just curious if there are superintendents out there who might have a hard time setting up a room like this, if you have any just quick advice for them.
No, I think you have to make a commitment to students, and that's the most important thing, is why are we here as public schools? It's to support our students and to challenge our students. And that's my only piece of advice, really, is make the commitment to providing what you need to for all students.
Well, thank you, Don, and thank you, Pat, on the line for joining us on the 21st today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo. Snow is falling, decorations are aplenty, and for many people, vacations are just around the corner. And as the saying goes, it's the most wonderful time of year. Also, perhaps the most stressful. Let's face it, close quarters with family can be difficult sometimes. Plus, if you're hosting, there's a lot to worry about. Food to prepare, trips to the airport, and presents to buy. And for those who might find themselves alone this time of year, that can be really rough too. So we have a couple stress experts to help us get through it all. We have Dr. Vale Wright, and she's on the line from Washington, D.C. She's the Director of Research and Special Projects for the American Psychological Association and a University of Illinois alum. Also joining us on the line from Chicago, Dr. Aaron Behrens, an assistant professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Illinois Chicago. Vale, Aaron, welcome to the 21st.
Great. Thanks for having me.
So, Vale, this time of year can be perhaps some of the busiest times for people. Students are cramming for finals here at work. We're, of course, wrapping up projects, heading out for Christmas or holiday vacations. And as we said, with travel, with holiday parties, we found that people are experiencing a lot of stress. Is that true?
Yeah, that is true. I mean, for most people, this is a joyful, positive time. But for others, like those you mentioned in the beginning of your segment, this can be a stressful time for them.
So what are some of the most widely common shared stressors surrounding the holiday months?
Sure. So some of the most common stressors, we really kind of think of four. One are these unrealistic expectations, particularly to be perfect, to have the perfect holiday, to do it all. Another is, like you mentioned, travel, having to manage time commitments. A third is money. A lot of people experience stress around the holidays about, you know, being able to afford the presents and the celebration. And fourth is really concerns about family conflict or the dynamics that happen when you get together with family you haven't maybe seen in a while.
So, Aaron, I think it's easy to also get wrapped up in the constant go, go, go of it all, right? You don't even realize that maybe you're stressed in the moment or that you need just a second to take a deep breath. So how can people take a moment to recognize the stress? What are the physical signs? And then how do they address that?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I mean, I think a lot of people don't even think to ask the question, how do I know that I'm stressed out? So, you know, when we're talking to people about recognizing stress, you know, everybody has unique signs or what we call stress signals.
Okay.
Some of those might be kinds of thoughts that go through your mind, like, you know, like Vale was alluding to, thoughts about perfection. I need to do everything right. I'm just getting overwhelmed by all that there is to do, or maybe making judgments about your ability to get all of that done.
Mm-hmm.
Other signals might be more physical, like muscle tension, headaches, changes in appetite, or maybe just noticing you're holding your breath and not breathing as you would normally. And then there are also behavioral signs, like, for example, maybe, you know, not wanting to get out of bed in the morning, trouble falling asleep at night, or maybe noticing being more irritable with other people or with your kids. And so I think, so first noticing that you are stressed is the most important place to start.
So I'm also kind of curious what role the weather plays in terms of stress this year. Days are darker earlier, temperatures are colder, we're not outside as much. Do you also find that that's a factor?
I think for some people it certainly is, and maybe not so much for others. So I would say if you notice you're somebody who is impacted by it getting darker earlier, figuring out ways to sort of get yourself activated in spite of the weather changes in the amount of light. And certainly if you're somebody who notices extreme changes, maybe finding a provider who can talk to you about, some of those, weather or season-dependent changes.
So, Vail, I'm curious, do you have one or two expert tips for individuals dealing with routine holiday stress, with what we were just talking about with the weather, any kind of stress around this holiday season? Do you have tangible tips to provide for them?
Sure. One of the most important things, and it's going to sound obvious, but that's because it's so important, it's to remember to still take care of yourself and engage in those self-care activities that are important. So like Erin mentioned, getting activity, making sure that you're still eating healthy, that you're getting enough sleep, the things that your mom wants you to do, those you should still be doing them, even though you have new time restrictions. I think the other thing that's really important for people is to use this time to really sit down and think about the traditions and the values that you have and evaluate whether they're lining up with the ways that you're acting. So really sit down, create a list of what's important to you about the holidays. Is it spending time and reconnecting with family? Mm-hmm. Is it using it as a time to reflect on the year and think about what you're grateful for? Is it a time to reflect on your faith or your spirituality? Whatever is your priority, make sure that you're acting in a way that's in line with that.
So what you're saying is just a way to a reality check, right? When you're feeling really stressed, maybe you go back to your list and you say, okay, what I really wanted to focus on this holiday season was reflecting on what I'm thankful for. So maybe being stressed about XYZ is not that important. Is that kind of what you're saying there?
Exactly. I think there's a lot of hype and commercialism around this time of year, a lot of pressure to give gifts and spend money. And I think that when people really think about what you value and prioritize, those things aren't really going to make the list. So, don't get caught up in that, but really think about what's important to you right now and act that in accordance with that.
So, Erin, I was curious about your thoughts on this particular topic.
Yeah, I definitely think I agree that sort of thinking about priorities and reflecting on sort of the reason we go through this period is really important. I think for a lot of us feeling really busy or stressed out at the holidays, just to take what Vail's saying kind of the next step is just, using a planner to actually schedule out those busy days to make sure that how you're spending your time is really mapping onto your values. And also making sure to schedule in time for yourself to do something for yourself, to relax, to exercise, mm-hmm. to unwind. And taking that time to give you a little boost in your energy and your mood will kind of make the rest of the holiday season feel more manageable.
Well, and for me personally, just to share a little piece in my life, I lost my father a couple years ago, and the holidays really changed for me and my family after that. He was a mainstay for us around this time. And so I also think it's really important to talk about the fact that holidays for some people aren't all about getting the family together. It's about loneliness or the loss of a loved one or the change of a tradition. So could we speak a little bit about that feeling and how it can be magnified, especially around holiday traditions? So Erin, what advice do you have for listeners who find themselves experiencing either literally being alone or the feeling of loneliness, which doesn't require you to be alone in a space, by the way?
Yeah, I think that's a really great point. I mean, a lot of people are feeling the loss of loved ones even more at the holidays. So I think for those, including yourself, and I'm really sorry to hear that, but
who are dealing with
that kind of serious loss, I think, it's nice to create time to honor the memory of the loved one who's gone, either by yourself or with other family members, scheduling out special time and an activity to do to like kind of fondly remember that person. So whether that's doing an activity that you used to do with that person, looking at family photos of your time together, but then just making sure that the remembrance has an end point and kind of scheduling something pleasant to do next to also be able to move forward and enjoy the holiday.
I think that's a great point, yeah.
Yeah, and I think for those who are otherwise alone, but maybe not because of the loss of a loved one, I think going back to planning out your time can be really helpful so that you have specific activities that you're planning to do at specific times. And again, like Vail said, those should be things that are important to you, in line with your values, they're enjoyable. And making sure to include some activities where you're around other people, even if they aren't necessarily your family members or friends. So even just going out shopping, going to a movie theater, or perhaps even reaching out and trying to join a meetup group or doing some activity that might put you in touch with other people who have similar interests at the holidays.
And Vail, along these same lines, in particular, if you're not necessarily somebody who's been dealing with a loss of a loved one, but more dealing with this idea and feeling of loneliness, maybe you're somebody who just relocated to a new city and you don't really know anyone, or whatever the case may be, what are your suggestions for managing the stress of that around this time of year?
Yeah, I agree a lot with what Erin was saying. I think it's very similar here. I think when we get stressed or we're sad, we have a tendency to avoid. Mm. And I want to encourage people to not isolate themselves, even if they're in a new place or they haven't created a large social support network yet, but to reach out to those who are family and friends that aren't maybe where you're located but somewhere else. And also, like Erin was saying, go to a restaurant, sit at the bar, and talk to the bartender or talk to the person sitting next to you. Go volunteer at organizations where other people will also be volunteering. So surrounding yourself with other people, making some new traditions for yourself, I think those are ways to help with the loneliness.
And Erin, I'm curious if you have found that there are support groups for people who are either feeling really stressed because they're in charge of all the holiday checklists, or someone who is feeling lonely.
Yeah, I think they're definitely, you know, kind of depending on what area people are in, certainly these types of groups can be found, whether it's on Facebook or other outlets, through churches or other community organizations. So I would say if somebody's interested in that kind of group, just to kind of look around, ask around. I know a lot of towns have, like mom Facebook groups that are region specific or things like that. So I definitely think, you know, these things are out there. We just have to dig around in our area to see what's near us.
And Vail, I'm curious if you could have any tips on how you could properly communicate to your family when you're feeling really stressed and perhaps you just need a minute. How would you best communicate or suggest to someone that they communicate that without feeling like they're going to hurt their loved one's feelings, for example?
Yeah, I think one of the important things to do is remember it is okay to take time for yourself. For one, most other people aren't going to actually notice if you step out of the room to get a breath of fresh air or take a walk. But even if they do, it's okay to just say, look, I just needed a little time for myself. I needed to take a break. And I think for most people, they're going to understand. I think the reason why we don't do these things is because we're worried, like you said, that they're going to judge us or have their feelings hurt. And the reality is they probably won't. So it's okay to just be honest, say you need to take a break, and, you know, engage in the self-care that you need.
Mm-hmm. So, Vail, as a fellow alum here of the University of Illinois, we are getting ready to go. I believe today might be reading day, and then the students are going straight into finals week. So what goes along with these times in the year, or this particular time in the year, is students feeling really stressed because of finals and cramming. So what are your suggestions for stress relievers for students in that situation?
So again, it's still really important to engage in self-care. That's making sure you're eating well, not just binging out of a vending machine, getting the sleep that you need, getting some activity. These are things that students probably know, maybe aren't following through on. What they might not be as aware of is that we know from the research on work productivity that taking a break, occasional breaks, periodic breaks that aren't too long, actually make you more productive. Mm-hmm. So it's important that students take breaks from studying, go get coffee with a friend, maybe create, you know, a playlist that will help motivate you to feel good. Whatever it is that's going to help maximize your studying, that's what you want to do. But it's really important to take those breaks.
I think what I'm hearing as an underlying theme here is finding a balance in everything, knowing what your priorities are, but also not getting lost in the weeds of it, so to speak, and really being able to ride the line back and forth between doing what you have to do, but also taking some time for yourself. So we
absolutely.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Oh, no, that. I'm just
agreeing. So we just have a couple minutes left here. I did want to wrap up this conversation with one kind of final thought or question here. Erin, I'll go to you for this one. There's a routine, everyday stress, then there's, of course, more serious stress. So could you delve deeper into what point should someone seek professional advice versus just kind of take these tips into mind as they go through the holiday season?
Yeah, I think that's a really great point. So I think, you know, if you're somebody who you're noticing that you're feeling down more days than not, or you're having trouble controlling your worry, not just at the holidays, but kind of in general, or if you're experiencing panic attacks or other kinds of intense anxiety that are getting in the way of getting things done in your life, getting in the way of your relationships, or just really weighing on you, or then kind of the more serious indicator of if you're having thoughts about hurting yourself or someone else, you know, reaching out to family members or other trusted people for to let them know that you need help. But you can also go to people like your family physician for a referral to see a psychologist, or you can also go to the Illinois Psychological Association website, which is www.illinoispsychology.org, to find a psychologist in your area. You can look through your church, other community groups, but just knowing to reach out if you feel like it's kind of more than you can handle on your own.
Well, I want to thank Dr. Erin Behrens from the Department of Psychology at UIC, also Dr. Vail Wright from the American Psychological Association in Washington, D.C., for joining us here on the 21st today. That is all the time we have today. And we are produced by Robin Lynn, Alan Montecilio, and Libby Foster, and Grace Stenson, our interns. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive director. Finally, a special thanks to producer Bob Holly. Today is his last day with the 21st. Bob, thank you so much for all your help these past few months. I'm Liz Westfield in for Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, and thanks so much for listening.